Good evening to you all. It's lovely to see you on such a wonderful balmy summer's evening here. You've made your way to come and listen to our first gospel address for the year 2020. We are looking forward to commencing tonight under the topic of our Finding Faith subject. It's going to be Walking with God, and we look forward to that. As an introduction to Brother Matt's talk this evening, which is that subject, Walking with God, he's asked us to take a reading from the book of Ruth and chapter 2. Looking forward then to our Brother Matt's presentation entitled Walking with God.
Thanks, Ralph, and good evening, everybody. Now, we all have a whole heap of passages in our mind, no doubt, and on the walls of our house that God will never leave us or forsake us, that God is always with us, that God will guide us in our lives. And sometimes we ask the question, well, how does that actually work? How does God guide us? We know the passage from Jesus where he says, ask and you shall receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you. You think, well, how does that work? How does God open doors? How does God reveal answers to us? Because we don't have bolts of lightning, we don't have visitations from angel, we don't necessarily have prophets in our day saying, thus saith the Lord. So how does God actually guide us? And so the theme of our night tonight is walking with God, focusing specifically on how God guides us through his providential care. Now, one thing I want to look at just very briefly is how the Spirit of God works, because God guides us via his Spirit. And we know his Spirit fills heaven and earth. And so the word Spirit is one of those words in the Bible. It's a very broad idea. It's a very big word. The English dictionary, our English language, likes to focus on specific words for specific meanings. Hebrew doesn't work that way. Hebrew uses words that have very broad application, and so does Greek, and the context will determine the application. And one of these ideas is the idea of Spirit, or Ruach and Pneuma in the Greek and Hebrew. So it is basic meaning, the most basic meaning, it is a current of air. And a current of air can be in two forms, a breeze that blows, which Jesus says, the wind blows where you want, you hear the sound, or a breath. Now as a breath and a wind, the wind can mean the invisible power of God. So it says of God, it's a mighty tempest that he blows and destroys. It can also be the force of God to create. So God speaks words, he breathes words out, and suddenly things happen all around the place. As a figurative mean, it can be an immaterial force or being. So the disciples, when they saw Jesus on the water, they thought it was a spirit, a ghost, something that was you could see but it had no body. It was an immaterial force or being. And in the kingdom age, we hope to have a spirit body, a body like the wind, a body that's not made of flesh and blood. Now over here on the breath side, it's something we need to live. It's a vital, life-giving element. And then into a more figurative application, it's ideas and sentiments that energize the mind and drive the body. So we have the word inspiration. So if I was to say something like, my wife inspires me to be a more organized person, right? Because I'm not. What am I literally saying? What does the word inspire mean? What does it literally mean? Anyone? Inspire, as opposed to expire. Come on, it's English. Yes. Breathe. You're breathing in. So inspire, as opposed to expire, is you're breathing something in. You inspire. Like that. And you think, well, how do I breathe in my wife? But we don't mean it in that sense. What we mean is that when I look at her example, that motivates me and inspires me. And it's by the same token, I walk into Hyde Park Ecclesia and I think, wow, that's a great atmosphere. Or a wonderful, warm environment. And I'm not just talking about the air conditioning. Now, what am I saying with that? What am I saying there? What we're saying is that the air in Hyde Park is good. Good air. So keep it up. But we're not saying that the air is good. What we're saying is that the vibe, the atmosphere, the friendly, people are friendly. We're all breathing this good air, and it makes us good, and we treat one another well. Now, when we get into John 4, it says, God is a spirit. You must worship him in spirit and in truth. And when Jesus says to Nicodemus, that which is born of spirit is spirit, what John does and Jesus does is he gets the idea here of a mind and an attitude that's breathing in godly things that will one day become a body that is immaterial and spirit, as opposed to a mind that is breathing in fleshly things that will only ever be flesh. So the two ideas come together in God. Not just God's plan for us, but God himself breathes things out and amazing things happen. So, of course, this is how God operates all through the earth. His spirit fills heaven and earth. And last year we looked at the idea of logos. And it says, without logos, God didn't make anything that was made. And so we see in creation, in the universe, it's full of meaning and it's full of purpose and it's full of power, right? Which is God's spirit. I didn't actually mean for you to turn the aircon on, but hey, I wasn't dropping hints, believe me. That would be rude. Now, of course, coming to the Holy Spirit, what does the word holy mean, by the way? I've just given it away. What does it mean? Separate. So separate spirit, separate breath. So what does it literally mean? It means that when God needed to do something special, he allocated a separate portion of his breath that allow people to do things that normal human beings can't do. So Samson was given the Holy Spirit, right? He had a separate breath that allowed him to knock over temples, to wipe out people with jawbones of an ass, all these amazing things, right? So the disciples could do miracles, right? So separate breath, a separate wind is enabling people to do things that normal people can't do. So that's literally what Holy Spirit means, a separate portion of God's Spirit over and above which that which sustains life, that is set apart to perform something special that normal people can't do. But we're not going to be looking at Holy Spirit tonight. What we're looking at tonight is how do we tap in on God's providence? What are we looking for when we're looking for God's providential hand? How does God guide us? And what we're going to be looking at is examples in the Bible where there was no miracles, where there was no angel that came down, where there was no bolt from the blue or writing on a wall, where people were guided by seemingly random circumstances and events, and the wise amongst them put those things together and they worked out that God wanted them to move in a particular direction. Now, this is a very important topic. It's one of my favorite topics. But it's a very important topic because we're living in a world where there is a counter-providential force, that there is a divine providential being that will answer our prayers instantly, that works anywhere, anytime, anyhow, right? And you don't have to wait. You don't have to look. You don't have to analyze. You say a prayer, you immediately get what you want. And, of course, I'm talking about Google. Now, one thing I've noticed is that the surprising number of comparisons between what technology enables us to do and God. Here's just one example of it. So God is omnipresent, Google is omnipresent. God is omniscient, Google is omniscient. God is omnipotent, Google is omnipotent. So what they're saying is Google is a better version of God because Google don't make you wait. Google has all these results in 0.02 of a second, where God will answer a prayer maybe in a year, 2 years, 5 years, which alongside 0.2 of a second doesn't look good. And so we're in this world where people, you know, I've been facetious with the Proverbs here, but trust in Google with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, just Google it, and Google will direct your path. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear Google, and of course their mantra, don't be evil. Thy search is a lamp to my feet and my time. You've heard Google is your friend, right? Just Google it, right? This is where Google is your friend. So, and here's another one. Their spirit fills heaven and earth. What's that? It's a mobile phone coverage map. Anywhere, anytime, anyhow. And now the really, really big thing with 5G is anywhere and anytime. The Internet of Things, multiple devices. Everything all on the one device, right? Wherever you happen to go. And what that's doing is it's setting up a culture and an expectation in people, right? And I love this advertisement. It was an old Telstra ad, right? Rock stars get what they want on demand. So God makes you wait. God will work with you over a lifetime. God will guide you, but only if you're concentrating and watching. You don't have to worry about that, right? You can basically expect and demand and get it. Proverbs say it's the glory of God to conceal a matter, right? And the honor of kings to search it out. So God reveals things, but you have to have the right mindset. You have to have patience. You have to read. You have to think. It takes time. Whereas these Google lazy rules, if you can't find it in 3 minutes or less, it doesn't exist. And the latest one, if it isn't on the first page of a Google search, it doesn't exist. So what we're seeing is there is a counter-providential force that says you can have whatever you want, whenever you want it, however you want it, and you don't have to wait. Yet we as believers are believing in a God that says, well, no, I'll guide you through your lifetime, but you're going to have to be in the right mindset, you're going to have the right attitude, and you're going to have to look and to pray and to read and to think, and it's not going to be quick, and it'll take time. And this goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, to be like the gods. And of course, we have our tree of knowledge of good and evil. We have our forbidden fruit, and it's competing in God's space like never, ever before. And we have to fight a counterculture. We have to carve time in our day when we can think. And it's an ongoing conversation. I don't have control of the devices that I own. I have to keep resetting myself. And I've come to the realization very few of us do have ultimate control. It runs away with us. We get distracted. We get sidetracked. And I don't think any of us have said, well, I've got this sorted. I've got God, I've got my technology, everything's fine. We're all kind of struggling. And when we have kids, it's struggling to get them to see the screen time. And it's very hard. But it's very important, because when we're tapped in that world, we're not hearing God. And God is not listening. So what I want to do as a first example is look very briefly at providence in the life of Ruth. Now, what is so important about the story of Ruth, apart from that it's a lovely love story, it's a romance, and we all like romances, but why is Ruth in the Bible? What's important about Ruth? Come on, people. Exactly. It is the line of Christ. So Ruth is critical. In the genealogy of Christ, it tells us about the line of Christ. And of course, Christ did not come from aristocratic blood. Ruth was a Moabitess. Married Boaz, his grandmother was Rahab. Right? So no aristocrats in Jesus' line, which is a very reassuring thing for most of us, I'm sure. Right? So here is Ruth. She is in the land of Israel. Right? She is a Moabitess. The moment she crosses that border, the record calls her Ruth the Moabitess. Why? Jews were very racist. They did not like Canaanites, and they hated Moabites and Ammonites. There wasn't a lot of friendship and love there. So she's a foreigner in a strange land. And so she arrives there, and Naomi's not in a very good state of mind. She's highly depressed. Things have gone wrong. What's the name Naomi gave herself? Mara, which means bitterness, because as she says, God has crushed me. The word in the Hebrew is crush. So God has gone against me, God has afflicted me, and God has crushed me. She's not happy. She's not in a good state of mind. So Ruth, brand new, she gets up in the morning and she says, we need food. Shall I glean? And the question is, like, where shall I glean? Where shall I go? This is your town. It's not my town. I don't know where I'm going. Now, what answer does Naomi give her? Typical of highly depressed people. What does she say? Off you go. Just go. So there's no guidance given by Naomi. Ruth is just left to find her way. Yeah, use GPS. Grab your iPhone on the way out. No, it didn't happen. Anyway, so verse 3, she says she went out and she just gleaned in a field. And where is the providence in verse 3? Can someone look at verse 3 and tell me what is the key word that tells us that God was... Now, from Ruth's point of view, what's the key word?
Happened.
She happened. She just so happened. Now, from Ruth's point of view, she's like, shall I go here? Shall I go here? Oh, that has nice flowers. That has lots of weeds. I'll go here. And it was just a random decision, just something where she thought, that looks nicer. It was an impulsive decision. Now, we know there was nothing impulsive. Nothing impulsive or random about that decision at all, because it led her to Boaz. Boaz and her met. boy meets girl and all the rest, and they end up getting married and having the line of Christ. So there's nothing random there, but from Ruth's point of view, it was a random decision. Now, how many of you have gotten to a meeting and you get up out of your chair and you look around the hall and you think, who shall I talk to? Think, him? No. Him? No, doesn't listen very well. No, don't get on very well. I'll talk to that person. And you go and talk to this person and you find that this problem you're sort thinking about for a week or a month, they've actually got the answer to your problem. Or you say something and they go, oh, I'm so glad you said that. I've been worried about that for some time. And something you've been praying about, suddenly either you've answered their prayer or God's got them to answer your prayer. But there was nothing that said, I must go and answer this person's prayer. You just did it because you said, oh, I'll talk to him. Why not? And these things happen. They happen all the time. And when we reflect back, we think, wow, that was a really amazing conversation. What made that happen? And it was things like this where we just make a decision to talk to a person and then suddenly the conversation turns into something amazing. So this is where we have to look at our lives and go, right, look at the circumstances I got here, here, here. Wow, my life took a turn in the positive here. What led me there? Oh, look at that. It was just a random decision. Now, so I've got here. In fact, I should have been doing that. That's the providential error. She just happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, what I love about the story of Ruth is there's so many angles to this story. And one thing I believe myself personally is that it's very much about the restoration of Naomi. When you look at Ruth doesn't do a lot. She simply does what she's told. And obviously she's caring about Naomi. She's motivated by good things, but she doesn't, of her own volition, do much at all. It's really Naomi that is the one that helps her and allows her to meet with Boaz, and Boaz then initiates things, and Ruth is just the person that's in the middle of all this. So one thing that goes all the way through Ruth is the restoration of Naomi. Now this, I think, is really quite amazing. So Naomi, as we know, loses her husband, as she loses both of her sons. Now, back then, there's no social security, no pension, so you lose the men in your house, and now you're stuck to gleaning. That is your only way of earning an income. There is no government benefits to come with it. So you're now destitute. You have nothing. And so we know the story. So the two daughters-in-law love Naomi. They want to come with her, but Naomi keeps on saying, go, go, go. Now, look at what she says in chapter 1, verse 8. So Ruth, Naomi says to her two daughters-in-laws, go return, each of you, to your mother's house. May God deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with me. Now, what is implied in that statement, do you think? May God deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with me. Had God dealt kindly to her from her point of view? Sorry? No, absolutely not. So it says, let God be as nice to you as you have to me, but I don't feel God's being very nice to me. Now, this is confirmed in verse 21, where she says, I left here full, God brought me back empty, God is against me, and the Almighty has broken me. So God is her worst enemy. God is opposing me, I don't know why, but he's broken me. Right? So she is in a highly depressed state of mind. So, Ruth goes out to glean, no guidance whatsoever. She ends up in Boaz's field, right? So Boaz gives her the parched grain. Boaz then says to his men, hey, keep leading lots and lots of things away. Don't touch her, don't annoy her, don't tell her to go. If you notice her behind, you want to do handfuls behind. So she picks up a lot. Now, she ends up coming home with about 10 kilos of grain in her first day gleaning, which is pretty good. You weren't supposed to get that much with gleaning. That's enough to open up a bread shop, not just to survive, which gleaning was just a survival ration. So Naomi looks at her on the way home and says, whoa, where have you been? Blessed be he who's taken knowledge of thee. So the mother's like, there's no way known you could have picked up that much grain with some kind person looking out for you. And Ruth says to her, she says, well, she says, this man, his name was Boaz. He is the one that I'm with. Now look at verse 20. Naomi said to her, "Blessed be he of God who has not left off his kindness to the living and the dead." Now you notice the change here in Naomi's attitude, right? So God now has not forsaken me. She's starting to see that, okay, random event, she's ended up with Boaz, he's a kinsman, this is our ticket out of this. God is working in this situation. Naomi knows God is working, and she's now acknowledged that, all right, God is dealing kindly with the living and with the dead. Now, this is amazing. I love this, right? So Ruth, you think about it from her point of view. She's got to get another husband. She's still young. She's got to get another husband. So you notice she stays near the reapers when she sits down and has dinner. Now, when Boaz meets her, he says, "I want you to stay near my maidens." Right, but at lunchtime, she sits near the reapers. So she's near the men. She's obviously wanting to get notice in some way, shape, or form. She comes back to Naomi, tells her the story. Then she says in verse 21, "He said, 'Keep fast by my young men.'" Now, he didn't say that. He said, "Stay by my young women." And notice what Naomi counters. She goes, "It's good, my daughter, that you stay past near the maidens." Right? So basically, Ruth said, "Stay near the young men." She goes, "No, stay near the maidens. Stick with the maidens. Don't budge from that field." So Naomi is waiting for Boaz to do something. He's obviously interested. He's obviously taking a proxy provider. So she's like, right, stay near the ladies. Give this man plenty of opportunity to obviously show more of an interest. So she sticks by the maidens of Boaz to the end of barley harvest and the end of wheat harvest. Now, that's quite a few weeks. Ruth goes out, gleans, come home. What happened? No, nothing. Right? So Naomi's looking, thinking, when is he going to make a move? I've given him ample time. He's a wealthy man. We're poor. He's a kinsman. When is he going to make a move? Now, chapter 3 comes along, and this is the absolute key to everything. When bad things happen in our life, and we go in on ourselves and we get so totally depressed and we lock the whole world out, sometimes the first step to our restoration is learning to live for other people. And of course, that's what the Bible teaches us, that money and power and status is irrelevant. But when we learn to live for others, that's when our life takes on meaning. And in chapter 3, she says, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it might be well with you?" And so now the experienced spiritual Naomi starts hatching a plan. And when Ruth does, and she sits at Boaz's feet, what does Boaz do? He thanks her for not chasing the young men. He says, "Thank you so much for not chasing the men, whether rich or poor." So he's obviously a little bit older, but he obviously isn't presuming upon his wealth. He wasn't an entitled person, clearly, that walked up to her and go, "Well, I'm rich, you're poor. Let's do it. Come on. You need me. Let's face it." He wasn't that kind of a person, Boaz. He was respectful, he was polite, and he certainly wasn't entitled. And so when Ruth finally propositions him, says, "Marry me or I won't get off your feet," right? When she finally says, "Do it," well, he says, "Well, thank you so much. I really want to do it." And when he sends her back in the morning, he gives her an extra parcel of grain. And what does he give her extra grain? Who's that for? Naomi. He says, "Don't go to your mother-in-law empty." So he knows absolutely that this is the mother-in-law working behind the scenes. He said, "All right, little nod to the mother-in-law." And the mother-in-law, when Ruth gets back, she goes, "Relax, it's in the bag. We just got to rip in here." She basically says, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter is. The man will not rest until he has finished the thing this day." She knows, absolute certainty. She says, "We've got it. He's basically going to work for us." Now, she's a very smart, switched-on woman. She knows men. We've got two sons and a husband. You've got to know men. All right, so that is providence. And as you can see, Ruth is just doing what she's supposed to do. It is Naomi that is, despite her depression, looking for God's signs, looking for God's providence. And when God does something, she acknowledges it and she starts to be restored. And of course, she ends up with little Obed, nursing little Obed. And the lesson for us is, brothers and sisters, even in trial and tragedy, God is still working. God is still looking after us. God is teaching us lessons. And the secret to everything, the secret to peace, happiness, recovery, contentment, everything is learning to live for others, which is exactly the lesson that Naomi learnt. Now, I want to go to another example now, and this is the example of Samson. So come with me quickly to Judges chapter 13 and verse 25. All right, and I'll read it from here. So in Judges 17, Samson's a young man. He's been born. He's a Nazarite from the womb. And he grows up, and it says, the Spirit of God began to stir him at times between Mahadan, between Zorah and Eshcol. Now, the word to stir is agitate, right? So whenever Samson would go for a walk, and he'd go through these places, Zorah and Eshcol, this place, Mahadan, which is like the camp of Dan, what it means, he'd get agitated, he'd get annoyed, he'd get upset, right? And God was stirring him up. Now, that frustration that he felt was not just frustration from a normal human point of view. God was stirring him up. You know, sometimes we get this sort of thing where something annoys us and we think, I should do something about that. And if something is a good thing, it would help others. Maybe it's something we need to do in our lives, or maybe it's something we need to commit to help someone else. But we're holding back and it keeps nagging us and stirring us up. And in the end, we do it. And we know we've done the right thing. We know we've made the right commitment. But sometimes making that commitment is very, very hard. And we get this nagging, this stirring feeling. Well, Samson had that. Now, what was it that stirred him up? What's special about these places? Well, the original inheritance of Dan was in the south of Israel, right down south. Now, where did the Danites end up as their inheritance? Right up north. Well, how did that happen? Well, the Danites moved in south and they've got the Philistines. Five cities of the Philistines are thinking, oh my goodness, we can't take that on. Edomites down south, this is all too hard. So the men of Zorah and Eshcol got together and they said, hey, let's send five men up north and just spy out the land. And they go right up to where the Zidonians are and they find a Zidonian retirement village where all the billionaires retire. And there's no police force because everyone's filthy rich. And they're all lying around fat and lazy and whining and dining. And the Danites go, we can beat these people. This is awesome. So they come back and they say, quick, get up, you lazy people. We're going to go and fight our battles. Be strong, be courageous. Let's fight. And the entire tribe of Dan march away. But the first place they camped was the camp of Dan. So Zorah and Eshcol was where they hatched the plan to desert their inheritance. And the camp of Dan was the place where it was all formulated. But Samson's father stayed. He said, this is our everlasting inheritance. We have marked out this land with our feet. God's given it to us forever. We are staying here. Right? And you find that whenever something goes wrong in Samson's life, he ends up at his father's house. And he's buried in his father's house, his everlasting inheritance. Right? So that's all the way through the record of Samson. So whenever he walks past these areas, he gets agitated, he gets stirred up because this is the place my countrymen sold out. This is the place where the Danites didn't have enough faith. This is the place where the fear of the Philistines got into my people and they got too scared, too nervous, and they bolted and ran up to greener pastures, literally greener pastures. The area of Dan in the north is a beautiful area. Right, so there it is in chapter 18. Right, the men of Zorah and Eshcol sent five men to spy out the land, right, and they camped in the camp of Dan, and they called it the camp of Dan to this day, right? So that's the history of the Danites. Whenever Samson walked through that area, he got angry, he got annoyed, he got sad that they didn't have enough faith. And it was those Philistines that made them scared, and the Philistines did it. I'm going to fix the Philistines. That's what God's raised me up to begin to deliver Israel. Right, I'm going to do something about this. So he marches down into the Philistine town and he's walking and thinking, right, what am I going to do? I'm going to get rid of the Philistines and I think I'll start with that one over there. And of course he met a girl. And Samson's life was very much up and down, right? The ladies were a problem for him, right? But the lesson for us, brothers and sisters, is God worked in Samson's life through an understanding of what was right and the agitation he felt when he saw his family, his community, going in another direction. And that stirred him up. And it was God stirring him and motivating him to try and fulfill his mission in life. So again, when we feel these stirrings and we examine ourselves and we think this is the right thing to do, don't ignore it. Don't make excuses. Don't go, yes, I'll do it tomorrow. The big bash is on tonight. It can wait. Right? Take action. Right? God is probably most likely stirring you. And this is how God works. God works by agitating us in these areas. Now, there's another one. The life of Haggai. We won't turn it up. Right? But basically, Haggai is a prophet who was in the when the Jews came back from Babylon. And they wanted to build the temple. They had all the materials all gathered. Things went wrong. They became disheartened. And so then the people started grabbing the materials for the temple and building and renovating their own houses. So there was a beautiful cedar man cave and another beautiful cedar spa room. And all the temple's materials were being used for their own houses. And Haggai comes along and goes, consider your ways. What are you doing? And he gives a message from God. This is what God has to say. Your lives aren't going well. You're not happy. Yes, you've got lovely houses, but things aren't going well for you because God wants you to consider your ways. So it was a Bible talk. It was a Bible talk. He spoke the words of God, and the people are listening, going, oh, yeah, you're right. And then at the end of the talk, it says, the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the spirit of Joshua, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people got worked up. They said, you are right, we have to do this. And they got up and they started building the temple. How did God stir them? Well, it was a Bible talk, wasn't it? And we hear Bible talks a lot in this place, and some of them are very, very good. And some of them we think, whoa, that's amazing. I should do something about my life. And then we think, tomorrow. And then it's not as urgent, and then life goes on. But this tells us that this is how God stirs us. And we hear lots of Bible talks, and they inspire us and they motivate us. Well, when they do, seize on that opportunity. And if we're thinking of something we ought to be changing in our lives, something we could be doing good, people we could be helping, do it. Now, I had a situation just yesterday. We're living in an area, there's four Christadelphian families in our area. We've never had them round for dinner in a year. Well, they never had us round for dinner, so there. But that's not the point. So we've been always talking about it, but we never have a free Saturday. And the Saturdays we have, I'm like, too hard. Anyway, my son hops up and goes, we should have someone around for dinner. All right, ask Lainey Pickering, see if she wants to come. No, Lainey's going to a fair. All right, just do the rounds and ask everybody else. Whoever can come, can come. So he comes home, he goes, they're all coming. And then Lainey texts and goes, could I still come? I'm not going to the fair anymore. So we ended up at 1 o'clock preparing for 17 people, which wasn't on the agenda. And I'm like, thank you, Lecky. But you know what? It was the best thing. It was the thing, it was something that we all got together, we all talked, different problems came up, we chatted, and in the end we all agreed it was an amazing thing, we have to keep doing it. Now we've been putting it off, and it's been in our minds to do something, and sometimes we need that catalyst to go, I'm going to do it. And when we do it, you think, wow, why didn't I do this 6 months ago? Right, so in the example of Haggai, it was a Bible talk that stirred them all up. And they went and they did it. And of course, the temple got built. So never, ever, ever despise the inspiration we get from a Bible talk. Now, Nehemiah's my favorite. He's an amazing example because when I was young, almost said back in my day, well, I guess I'm 45. Anyway, when I was young, we used to hear from some speakers that God speaks to us through the Bible. We speak to us, God, through prayer, and that's it. And if we ever sort of talk too much about providential things, some people go, oh, that's a bit churchy, a bit Pentecostal, we don't want to be like that. Well, they would have hated Nehemiah, right, those people, because Nehemiah looked at his whole life from the viewpoint of God's providence, right? So his whole life was spent looking for God's hand. So all the plans that he had were attributed to God's plan. So he says, you know, God had put it in my heart to do certain things at Jerusalem. It wasn't his plan. When he got there, he thought, what's the best thing to do? That's an amazing thing. Yep, I'll do that. It was God that put it in my heart to do these things. So then he calls a meeting, and the meeting goes really well. He says, well, God had put it in my heart to do it. It's the right thing to do. God inspired me. God moved me to do these things. Right? And then deliverance was to good planning was attributed to God. It was known to us that all our enemies, that God had brought their plans to naught. And this is how Nehemiah talked to everybody. God is with us. God is victorious. It's not our great ideas. It's God that's working through us. And so as a result, the people were inspired and they glorified God. And all the congregation said, amen, and they praised God. But not just that. All the enemies of Israel, all the conspirers, the Sanballats and the Tobiah who were trying to overturn this work, they kept on hitting hurdles and roadblocks and things kept going wrong for them. And guess who they blamed, which is an amazing testimony to Nehemiah. His enemies attributed his success and their failure to God. Now that is an incredible thing. It means that Nehemiah must have been full of this, talking so much about it, that when everything kept on going wrong, they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. So that's the example of one man and how much inspiration that person can do, to the point that the enemies of Israel looked at their failure and thought, gee, it must be Nehemiah's God bringing everything to naught. So Nehemiah was a product of his lifestyle, and his lifestyle revolved around God. Now, this is something which we need to do. We need to look at our lives in retrospect and go, that went really well. That was an opportunity, a door opened there, and see that this could be God guiding our lives, even in the bad things. Now, another thing I'll consider very briefly are dreams. Now, obviously, we have to be a little careful with dreams. But if you look at the history of God's providential guidance, so many people were influenced by dreams. Now, I've had dreams that have got me out of bed. I'm in a very positive mindset. I feel very encouraged. I remember when I was baptized, I was 19 years old, and I was stalling. I knew I should be taking my life more seriously, and I was stalling, and I had two nightmares about the judgment seat. And I woke up, and I remember it was that and a near miss on the road, where I just drove straight through a give way sign. And I remember all of those events happened within 3 days. And I remember thinking to myself, all right, I should do something about this. Right? But things like that can happen. And God can set up a state of mind. God can do things through these sort of mediums. Obviously, we have to be very careful with this sort of thing. But when you look at the big, long list of people that God has manipulated through dreams and the history books, men like Napoleon basically had a dream that said, you're going to be a great man. Even people like Hitler had a dream that said, you're going to try and take over the world, right? So people who are part of God's plan and purpose. You know, Hitler was the hunter that drove the Jews into the land. Right, people who did amazing, great things. Alexander was told he's going to be immortal. And he went into battle believing nothing could touch him because of a dream. Remember the dream when he went into Jerusalem and he dreamed of the priest coming out riding a colt. And he jumps off his horse and bows down. And his men are going, what are you doing? That's the enemy. And he says, well, I dreamed this exact scenario. I dreamed it in a dream. Right? The same with the wise men. The same with, what is his name? Jacob and Laban. Laban's about to do harm, and the angel says, don't you dare touch him, in a dream. So this is another way that God operates. All right. Now, I now want to talk about a few of the more difficult negative aspects of providence. Now, how does God's providence work in difficult times? And how should we view those difficult events? Because we're all aware that tragedy happens, things that are very hard confront us, and we have to learn how to deal with it. Now, Josiah was one such example. Right? Josiah was told, because of his reforms, he was told by the prophetess Huldah, look, you've done an amazing job, but it's too late. The Babylonians are going to come, and there's nothing you can do about it. It is set in stone. However, because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before your God, I'll gather you to your fathers, you'll be gathered to the grave in peace, and your eyes won't see the disaster that I will bring on this place. Now, how did that happen, by the way? Now, if it was me, I'd be thinking, thank you, God, a little cotton wool ride to Tonga and a hammock and being fanned, and I'll just die in peace in a tropical land and I won't see the disaster. How did Josiah die? He shouldn't have been in the fight. An arrow in the gullet. He's like, get me out of here, I'm wounded. And he dies. And you think, that's not what I had in mind. You know, that would have hurt, right? But that's God's providence and God's mercy to stop him from seeing something that would have highly distressed him for the rest of his life. We've only got to look at how Jeremiah reacted to the Babylonians and the remorse that he said, how much it weighed upon him that the people were taken and the temple was destroyed, to see that it would have traumatized Josiah. But it wasn't an easy thing. It was an accident. It was an act of war. And as we see, basically, he wasn't supposed to be in that battle. Pharaoh Necho actually had a dream saying, go up and take on defend the Assyrians against the Babylonians, which Josiah looked at and thought, no way in the wide world am I going to let that happen. I hate the Assyrians. He goes to fight, not knowing that God wanted Pharaoh Necho and Syria to come together and the Babylonians to take them all out. So that was God's plan. Josiah didn't see the end from the beginning, did not see things from God's point of view, interferes in a fight that he shouldn't have, and he got shot. Now, from Josiah's point of view, that's quite a harsh way to go. But when we look at it from God's point of view, all God did is he moved him from there and popped him over here. And sometimes we find that very, very hard because we're not there, we're here. And this is all we know, and there is a very distant thing. And there's another example of how God operates in the face of tragedy. Exodus 21 verse 12, whoever strikes a man so that he dies will be put to death. Now listen to the next verse. But if he did not lie awake for him, there's an accident, but God let him fall into his hands, then I will appoint a place of refuge. So when it comes to accidents, the Bible says any accident happens because God allows it to happen. God could intervene, but he chooses not to in his providential wisdom, which sometimes we don't understand, and sometimes it takes a lifetime for us to understand why these things happen. But Exodus says God in accidents permits an accident to take place. And in the case of manslaughter, there were cities of refuge that they could run to. So just remember, when things happen that are tragic and we're looking at a reason why, sometimes God is looking from the end from the beginning. Josiah had no way of knowing that God wanted Babylon to take all of that area and take Syria and Egypt and take that entire region because it was part of God's broader plan. He didn't see the end from the beginning. He only saw a limited point of view and he acted within the circumstances and made a mistake and he died. Now here's another one, right? So Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. When they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel and Abel killed him. Then God said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? Now if you were Adam and Eve and you had to deal with that situation, what would be the number one question that you would have for the rest of your life? It's all in the then. If God could confront Cain after he hit him on the head, why couldn't God confront him before and let Abel live? Why? And that would be a fairly reasonable question for Adam and Eve to ask for the rest of their days. Why did God allow that to happen? Now, the only answer I've ever been able to find, and I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, is that it's a fairly extreme thing to have siblings kill one another. I don't know if you've ever heard of it in Hyde Park. Hasn't happened in Cumberland yet, where a brother or sister kills each other. Not a very common event at all. So if it's an indication of Adam and Eve's parenting as first parents, it probably means that they were not really coping with the whole thing. But what do we know about the next boy? He fathers the very first ecclesia. So Seth fathers the ecclesia of God. And so maybe it was a wake-up call. Adam and Eve, you've got to get over what happened. You've got to now live here and you've got to make this work and I need an ecclesia. And so Abel was taken from there and moved to there. And this is what Hebrews says. All these died in faith having not received the promise. God just moved him from there and popped him over there. and said, that sense of loss will make you a stronger, better person, and he's over there, it doesn't matter. Now, this is a very hard thing to put into our minds, and we struggle with this, right? But that's how God sees our life, right? So there's Abel, there's Josiah. Mortality is a very short thing, and there's eternity stretched out before us. God is working in both realms, right? But that's how we see it. Mortality is all we know. And eternity, well, we believe it, but sometimes we don't, and sometimes we doubt it, and sometimes I think, gee, I hope we're right. I haven't spent 45 years of my life following fable. Sometimes we have these thoughts, and it's not as rock solid as we would like it to be. And so we're not sure about these things, but seeing things from God's point of view is the key. Now, one person who did was Paul, right? Paul in jail. He doesn't know if he's going to get out or not. He's writing to the Philippians, and he says, look, I might die here, or I might get out. And he says, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Now you think, wow, that's his honest position. And he says, if I live, I can help you people out, which is really, really good. But if I die, I'll be in the kingdom, which is even better. And he says, I can't choose between the two. Now, there is a man that had his faith honed to the point where he did live in eternity, and he saw this world as just a temporary thing, and he knew absolutely that was going to happen. And from his point of view, just cut my head off now, please. It would be so much easier. Now, sometimes we have this. I remember when I was a single man, I wasn't married, I had no family, and I came back from a camp, and I thought, gee, if I had died now, I'd be very happy because I feel like I'm at my best, close to God. Now I think to myself, no, I don't want to die. I've got two children. I've got a wife. I'd like to see the matter through. It would be very hard to handle that scenario. But that's the key, is seeing it the way Paul saw it. And God sees it, where eternity is everything. Immortality is just this very brief thing, and God is operating between the two realms. And Romans 8, keeping that in perspective, all things work together for good. And this is how we handle tragedy. It's not removing the pain. It's learning how to think about the pain so that we can see it in perspective and move on. Right? And understanding it from God's point of view is a big part of that. Here's another one. God in persecution, providence. So you think from the Jerusalem Ecclesia's point of view, Paul marches in, Saul, and he's persecuting everybody. He's throwing them in jail. He's killing people, testifying at their death. And everyone scatters. Now you imagine having to leave your house, pack your gear, and run off to Murray Bridge or Mildura or Victoria and run away from Adelaide because you're going to die and you've just left a dead uncle who didn't run away quick enough. You'd be thinking, where is God in all of this scenario? How is God working? Why did God do this to me? What about you'll never leave or forsake me? You just killed uncle. And you would be very, very confused and upset. And this is how these people would have felt. But Acts offers us a little bit of perspective that as they ran and were scattered throughout the whole earth, they preached the word with them. And so the gospel was spread from Jerusalem throughout the whole earth. But it wasn't in ideal circumstances. It wasn't like, you've won a 12-month Bible mission tour, all expenses paid, well done, off you go. It wasn't that thing at all. It was like, you've got to run for your life, but I know the people you're going to talk to, you're going to spread the message and the good news. All right, so that's how God can operate. And sometimes we look at the trial and we look at the pain and we think, where is God in all of this? But that's how the gospel was spread. And from God's point of view, sometimes people need a bit of a sting to motivate them to make serious changes in their lives. I think we all do. Now, Job, I don't want to go through the whole book, but if you want to summarize Job's trial, it's like, why? Right? And when God finally answers Job, God doesn't actually give him an answer. God just says, this is your world. This is my world. My world is not your world. You don't understand why I do things because I'm playing at a universal level and you're not. Now, that is a paraphrase of God's explanation. But I've even more paraphrased it. Job's there. It's not fair. And God says, yes, it is. You just don't understand things from my point of view. Now, us parents know this. We know this very well. We hear this all the time. As a parent, children, I'm sorry. As a parent, you make judgment calls that you know your child will hate you for. And they will loathe you and they will curse your name. But you make it because we see further into the future and we understand the consequences and the ramifications. And so more, very often in the life of a parent, we get, it's not fair. And we just have to say, if we can't explain why and make you realize, we just say, well, yes, it is. But one day, when you're a father, you will know. You will know. Right? It's exactly the same with us and God. Our children operate in a very small world, and we're trying to make their world bigger, so they see things from our point of view. But in God, and God's whole conversation with Job is exactly that. You're looking at it from this point of view. This is my point of view, and until you can get there, you're never going to understand why God does things. Now, one last thing, there's a few things I just want to wind up on, but how does God use us to answer prayers? And this is when I think providence becomes a very powerful thing. Often we look for God in our life and we're looking for a bolt from the blue, we're looking for something amazing, something miraculous. And when someone puts their finger on the answer to our problem, when someone helps us, we miss it. We think, oh, well, thank you very much for that. And we don't really realize that, well, God made that person come to me to actually answer my problems. And it comes down to this passage here, and there's another one I want to consider after this. No temptation has taken you that is not common to man, but God is faithful, will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape. Now, if you encompass that with trial and tribulation, that's actually not strictly true. If you had the death of a spouse, right, the death of a loved one, the death of a child, none of us can handle that. And if we were all alone in the world to handle it, we wouldn't. We would collapse, we would burn, we would crash. But God will provide other people to bear the burdens. And this is how God's providence works. God answers prayers not through amazing miracles. God answers prayers through other people who are God to us at that time. And this is what Timothy says. If I tarry long, I want you to know these things, that you may know how you should behave yourself in the house of God, which is the ecclesia. Now our Bibles all say the living God. The isn't there. The ecclesia of living God. So all of us are living God. We are all God to one another. And when we do kind deeds, we're showing God's kindness. When we are honest, we're showing God's truth. When we're compassionate, we show God's compassion. And somebody prays over there, God moves that person to deal with that issue. Someone prays over here, you are brought in to help that person out. And that's how it works. And it's an amazing thing. And the answer to Naomi's prayers was Ruth. And the answer to Ruth's prayer was Naomi. And God just had to get both of them in the position when they were actually working in symbiosis, and that's God's providence. We answer one another's prayers. But it all comes down to, are we in the headspace and are we willing to do so? And David's another one. His sin with Bathsheba, he says to God, please forgive me, don't kill me, don't destroy me, because if you forgive me, I will teach transgressors your ways. What I've gone through, what I've experienced, I will use that to turn other people. I will be able to relate to people. And sometimes when we go through terrible things, and I had a breakdown 7 years ago, followed by my wife getting cancer the very next year. Probably the worst 2 years of my life ever. But now 6 years on, you look back on that event and you think, is my faith stronger? Yes. Was it nice? No. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Right? But people were always there when they needed. People were always helping. People, you know, and amazing things happened. Like, you know, you have these little doubts and things like that. And I had this pet bird, and she, when I was doubting the existence of God, this bird would just fly around and land on my shoulder, land on my little pet. And I'm like, of course there's a God. There's a mind in that bird. You know, when you're feeling destitute, someone just turns up and cleans the house, you know, and you could never say God had forsaken us. So it wasn't a nice thing to go through, but you see the truth of this and you realize that this really is real, that this is how God operates, right? So, where is it? Oh, this is Paul, of course, the things that he went through, how he was able to help others. And this is relating to what I was saying. I planted, Apollos watered, God gives the increase. So we work, we labor, we help. But sometimes God is the one that makes sure that he gets what they need, they get what they need, and people are turned around and all that sort of thing. So summarizing where we've been. We've looked at the providence that Google and the tech world provide. It's instant answers to instant prayers, gratifying the animal in human nature. But God is looking for a different mindset, right? Be still and know that I am God. And we're living in a world where God is everywhere if we're in tune with it, if we're listening to it, if we're trying to hear it. You know, and I remember whenever I doubted, right, whenever I doubted the existence of God, it was always my bird that flew into the bedroom and just flew on my side. Now, I always look at that and think, it was uncanny. I go through these really strong doubts and the bird would be flapping around and come and land on me. And I look at that and think, well, is this God? Is this God telling me something? That whenever I'm doubting, well, just look at that animal. If you look close enough, you will know there's a God. So these little things, if we're not in the mindset, if we're watching a movie, if we're doing other stuff, we're not going to get it. We're not going to see it. Random conversations will just be random conversations. We have to be in that mindset. So are we making time to reflect back on our lives and consider, like Naomi had to do, like Joseph did, where he said, it all worked for good. Don't stress. It's a good thing that you put me through that tough time. Are we listening to our nagging conscience? Well, but David said that his conscience was bearing down on him and grinding him into the dust over what he did. Are we sensitive to the impulse to do good? When we get that feeling to do something right, do we do it? God might be stirring us to do it. Do we act when God agitates us, when we feel powerfully about something, when we feel wound up about something that's not right and we think, well, I should do something about that. I should do a good thing for somebody else. I should change my life, right? Are we acting on those things? Do we act on the inspiration we receive from the Bible? Do we see God in all creation? And when trial and tragedy comes in our lives, are we looking to see how God might be using that experience to maybe help others? You know, I believe very strongly that there are some tragedies you will go through for no other reason then you are the one that's going to answer the prayer of someone who's about to go through that tragedy who does not have the support structure that you do to get you through it. So the only reason God will put you through a tough time is to allow you to help someone who's about to do it. There's no other reason. Possibly that's why Job experienced what he did. This happens. Now, if we're not looking from God's point of view, we're not going to see it. And are we making time to think? There is a mindset that is self-serving and selfish, brothers and sisters. And then there's a mindset that is actually very in tune to God's word. There's two states in us. There's an animal, which is selfish and self-absorbed, and there's a godly in us, which is loving and caring and kind. And when we're humble and we're contrite and we're respecting the word and we're absorbing and we're sensitive to God, God is speaking and we're listening and we're walking with God. Thank you.